It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. It was the summer of 2017. Governor Wolf and Republican legislative leaders were struggling to deal with a $2 billion deficit while they worked on a revenue plan. As the legislature takes up the governor's new budget plan, what is the overall fiscal health of the Commonwealth? We're joined on the line from Harrisburg by Pennsylvania Treasurer Joe Torsella. Welcome to the Confluence, sir.
Thanks. Good to be with you, Kevin.
So briefly, how would you assess the Commonwealth's fiscal health?
It's a great question. You brought back some old and not especially good memories with your walk down memory lane. The fiscal health of the Commonwealth has improved. There was a deposit to the rainy day fund for the first time in more than a decade. We are not talking this year because of improvements in revenues and some other things. There's not a lot of conversation about a huge gap that needs to be bridged. There's generally not the expectation that we're going to have a budget process that, you know, that bleeds over the deadline and goes into September and October. And, you know, we've been slowly but surely making some incremental investments in things that power our long-term prosperity. All that's in the good news column. In the not-so-good news column is we need to be honest that a lot of how we got to this state has been through a series of kind of one-time fixes. The thing that worries me the most, we're perhaps of all the 50 states the one with the least reserves to weather any possible turbulence that may come in the economy. And that rainy day fund deposit I mentioned was on the order of $22 million. For a state with an operating budget of $33 billion-ish contemplated, that's not enough money to fund operations for the recommended, you know, month that most states have. That's, in fact, not enough money to fund operations for, you know, an hour of any given day.
Right.
So our situation is better, but it is, everyone should understand it's precarious. And everyone should also understand that the vital question is not whether a budget gets done by July 1st. It's, does a responsible budget get done by July 1st? And is that budget going to do the kind of things that will position us to, as say, weather any unexpected bumps we may have in the road? The other thing that I'd say about our fiscal health is, and this is not a punt, but you know, the rating agencies out there look at all states when they evaluate the debt that states issue, and what the rating agencies say about us, it's not terrible, but it's nothing we should. It's nothing we want to write home and brag about. We are currently still ranked at among the bottom of states in our credit worthiness. We're not junk bond status, but we haven't improved. We haven't started to climb back. And by the way, that credit rating costs taxpayers money. Every year that we have it, it's kind of a backdoor tax on Pennsylvanians.
Whether it is the savings or the credit rating or other aspects of Pennsylvania's economy, the state is often ranked in the high 30s or even low 40s in overall economic evaluation. What can this state do to maybe even get into the top half of states?
Well, that's a question we should be asking about lots of things. There are some areas we rank near the top where I wish we didn't. So, for example, we are number one leading in student debt. But among the things that we could do that would really make Pennsylvania in the long term more prosperous is to take a serious and hard look at how we are slowly but surely pricing people out of higher education. By higher education, I do not mean necessarily 4 year four years in an Ivy League. I mean anything after high school, because in the economy we live in now, 95% of the jobs that have been created since the end of the Great Recession have gone to people who have something after high school, whether that's a vocational or technical certificate or a two-year degree or a four-year degree. So we've been saddling our graduates with debt. The costs of higher education have climbed by factors of nearly threefold over 30 years or so. Pretty much at the same time, the average Pennsylvania family's real wages have not budged. And so at the very time we most need to equip our young people with the tools for the 21st century, we are pricing them out of being able to get to it, and we're saying, oh, the only way you can do it is if you take on a mountain of debt that makes it less likely you'll buy a house, start a family, start a business, any of those things. That's the place I'd start to answer your question. It's not where I'd stop, but it's a beginning.
The governor's budget called for nearly a $1 billion increase in spending. Some Republican leaders have been critical of that, saying the state's revenues don't support that figure. Your reaction? Do the revenues support the amount the governor's asking for in spending?
I'm going to reserve judgment on that question until I see what the final proposed negotiated budget looks like, because there in the past there've been a lot of one-time tricks and gimmicks. I have my own policy views. So, for example, I think the governor's proposal to give Pennsylvanians a raise by raising the minimum wage is eminently sensible and long overdue. And if we want to help lift people out of poverty, it's one of the best ways to do that. And it's about time we set about trying to lift that. But those views I'm giving you, those are kind of my own policy views. They're not me speaking sort of officially as treasurer. So as treasurer, what I want to say to Democrats and Republicans, the governor and the legislature, is, look, the issue is we can have arguments about the appropriate level of spending here, the appropriate level of revenue there. You can raise revenue, you can cut spending. What I care about most of all is that those two sets of numbers match. To me, all those are interesting questions, but the bigger question is, are we going to avoid doing what we've done in the past few years, and that is balance the budget by one-time gimmicks and revenue infusions that everyone had a hand in, unfortunately, on the order, I think, more than $1.5 billion in one of our more recent budgets. I want the numbers to match. I want them to match honestly. I want us to do what every Pennsylvania family does, which is figure out how to make the choices to get through the year and invest in the things that will build prosperity in the long run.
You mentioned the increase in revenues. So why not? Would you advocate more money going into the rainy day fund? Because you said earlier,
I would. I mean, I am very concerned about about the sort of status of our reserves. But to put this in terms that take it out of the Harrisburg lane, if all we do as a Pennsylvania family is simply figure out how to pay the bills and don't make provision for the unexpected thing that's going to arise, the car repair, the medical emergency, let alone some of the longer term priorities, then we're not really doing our job. But I'm really concerned as treasurer that 10 years into this, that the balance in our rainy day fund is $22 million. That's a start. It's better. But we need to do a whole lot better, because there will be a downturn. I hope it's a long way away. But there will be one. And when it will come, we'll have to do one of two things. And the recession is the worst time to do those things. One would be to cut spending, especially for the most vulnerable. The other would be to raise revenues at a time when that's the exact opposite of what we should be doing. I want us to build up those reserves earlier so we're ready when the recession comes and we can manage through it.
Your office recently announced new features to the transparency portal. What is the purpose of the portal, and what would these new features do?
The notion behind the transparency portal is to make it easier for people like you, as well as for every interested citizen, to understand more clearly what's going on with the state's finances. We want to shine more sunshine, not less, on the finances of the state. So we've now released, I think this is our fifth kind of update, but you can now see the state of the state's current spending in real time. You can see several years' worth of data. You can see the balance of the general fund day by day, moment by moment. You can see the long-term trends in our debt. You can download all this and analyze it on as you wish, not just as we're presenting it to you. We've made it all much more accessible, much more user-friendly, and we brought it into the open. When I got here, I was stunned when I went around for my first series of meetings that legislators had the same question for me. They would say, what's the balance in the general fund? Now, in a state with, a $33 billion budget and a treasury that's custodian of $100 billion, the idea that anyone had to ask me what the balance of the general fund was struck me as crazy. So we've put it out there as a dashboard. You can see in real time what's going on, and I'm proud of that. We've really won some national plaudits for doing that. More importantly, I think it's a tool that will help Pennsylvania help Pennsylvania develop more responsible financial habits going forward, and a tool to help restore people's faith in government, which has been challenged in so many ways. But you know, government is indispensable, and there are certain things only government can do. And I want to, by what we do here and the way we conduct ourselves, and the focus we put on integrity and transparency, I'm hoping we're in part helping to repair that confidence deficit and to bridge that gap for people.
So is this like any citizen going online, checking their bank account, their expenditures, their checking account, what came in, what went out? Is it that kind of analogy?
It's close. We're not quite, and there's some legislation that will hopefully do this. We're not quite at what's called checkbook level data, which is where you can literally look down to every expense as you could in your own, if you go on online or use Quicken or something like that. We're getting much closer. What you can see now that you could never see before is the checkbook balance. You can see spending by department. You can see 3 years of spending by department. You can see for the first time what our level of debt as a state is and how that is changing over time. So it's getting closer to what you can see in your bank account, and it is your money, so you should be able to do just that. It's not quite there yet, and we're going to keep going until we get it there.
Pennsylvania Treasurer Joe Torsello, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Good to be with you.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Megan Harris. Still ahead on The Confluence, much attention is being paid to high-tech jobs in the region, but a new program is being launched today to bring underrepresented people into the building and construction trades. The program guarantees trade apprenticeships for those who successfully complete and graduate from the program. A new report on school breakfast shows thousands of eligible students still aren't being served. What can new goals from the governor and a local pilot project do to affect participation? And nutritionally, how important are these breakfasts to children? Get more stories, conversations, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence at wesa.fm/confluence.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, a weather beacon is installed on the Gulf Tower in downtown Pittsburgh in 1956. The giant structure covers the entire face of the building's 50-foot pyramid with 4 miles of fluorescent and neon tubes. The lights cover the 39th through 44th floors, each with a different color representing temperature, precipitation, humidity, and wind speed. Temperature is indicated by the top three tubes ranging from dark blue at below zero to red at 80 degrees and above. Below that, shades of purple represent precipitation, followed by different greens indicating humidity, and pinks for wind speed. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Imagine you're out and about around Pittsburgh and you stumble upon a hand-knitted heart along with a message that brightens your day. Spreading kindness through creativity. That's the mission of the PGH Handmade Hearts Initiative. 90.5 WESA's Brian Cook has more.
The combination of creative expression and a great deal of love, Barbara Grossman says, are the ingredients that make up the PGH Handmade Hearts Initiative. She says the mission is simple.
It's just to foster compassion for those impacted by acts of violence and hatred, as well as to discourage future acts of this nature.
It's a push to help put smiles on the faces of those who come in contact with the custom-made hearts, made of various materials, then left in public places. Back in 2005, Grossman founded the annual Pittsburgh Knit and Crochet Festival, which brings people from the creative arts world together in Greentree. It began as a fundraiser for the Waldorf School of Pittsburgh and eventually led to the creation of PGH Handmade Hearts. A small tag is placed on each creation that says, if you find this heart, it's yours to keep, or you can pass it on.
Maybe if somebody's having a really rotten day and they find a heart at a bus stop or in a library or a coffee shop, at a grocery store, they'll pick it up and they'll read this nice little kind message, and it might change their attitude.
Grossman says she was moved to help promote love over hate by recent events here in Pittsburgh.
The Tree of Life tragedy was the catalyst for the handmade hearts, but it was as if it was the icing on the cake for me. It shook me really to my core, and I kind of felt like, you know, I need to do something.
As the initiative has caught the attention of other caring groups and individuals, material donations have flowed in from various businesses, and Grossman says she seeks volunteers at the festival and through her website to help spread the positive messages.
It can be clay, it can be wooden, wire, fabric hearts are quilted, they're sewn, they're hand sewn, they're, you know, string hearts.
People are coming from all over the country, actually, for this, which initially was startling, and now it's just par for the course.
Back in the 1970s, Randy Grossman won 4 Super Bowls as a tight end with the Steelers. These days, he assists his wife with the creation of PGH Handmade Hearts. He says the creativity and meaning behind such work should be all-inclusive.
This really is a populist thing. You don't have to submit these to anyone. There's no fundraising involved in this. This is as purely grassroots as grassroots can be. If you're moved by this, go ahead and make some hearts and distribute them.
And as the hearts have been distributed and found throughout the community, Barbara has begun to hear feedback. Here she reads a thank you card she received.
Thank you for the gentle hearts with which you are peppering our city. I hope you never underestimate the power of a heart to make an indelible change. I'm proud to know you. Yeah, that's nice. It means a lot.
A small piece to the effect of those handmade hearts, impressing upon people the importance of paying it forward and treating others with a bit more kindness. I'm Brian Cook, 90.5 WESA News.
Who's making a difference in your neighborhood? Share your suggestion for our series WESA Celebrates 90 Neighborhoods, 90 Good Stories at WESA.FM/90. Made possible with support from UPMC, life-changing medicine.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Great emphasis is placed on high-tech jobs in this region, but there's still another path, perhaps closer to Pittsburgh's industrial roots. The Builders Guild and Pittsburgh Gateways today are launching a redesigned pre-apprenticeship program for people seeking a career in the trades. Jeff Nobers is the executive director of the Builders Guild of Western Pennsylvania. He joins us by phone as he helps prepare for today's launch. Welcome, Jeff.
Good morning, Kevin. How are you?
I am well, thank you. I hope you are as well. Jeff, would you give us an idea about the need for workers in electrical, plumbing, carpentry, steam fitting, and more? Is that need growing? And if so, is that because of new construction, new work available, or rather replacing longtime workers who might be retiring?
Well, it's really it's a combination of the two. At the present time, it's really more based on the increasing work in our region. If you look at the 12-county southwestern Pennsylvania corner, a typical year, or what's considered to be a normal year of non-residential construction, is somewhere around $2.8 billion. Mm-hmm. This year, we're projecting that number to be closer to $5.5 billion. So, you know, we're in a market that is at historic highs, literally double what you would consider to be a very healthy market for our region. So that's driving a lot of that need right now. But as we look out a couple of years, we are going to start to see retirements at far greater numbers than we see right now. Right. And if we look ahead to 2022 through, you know, roughly 25 or 26, we easily could be losing 10 to 12,000 people in that time frame as we get the tail end of the baby boom generation leaving the workforce.
Right. You're calling this a redesigned pre-apprenticeship program. So how intensive is it?
Well, the biggest change to the program that we've made in taking over the management of it is folks that come through this program are guaranteed to get into one of the trade apprenticeship programs. And that may not sound like a big deal to the average person, but it really is, because these are very competitive apprenticeships to get into. And, you know, the reality is you do have to have technical skills. You do have to have very solid math skills. You have to be able to do problem solving on the fly out on a job site. So there's a lot of those things that come into play. It's not just picking up a hammer and pounding a nail. And, you know, what we really emphasize to the folks that are in our program, we spend a lot of time on the math skills, especially as they relate to the kind of math you need in construction. We also spend a lot of time on interpersonal communications and how to communicate with others on the job site, because these are all very critical things. And if you get through that 6-week course and you graduate, you know, that's when it triggers that guarantee. And we will ensure that you are placed in an apprenticeship program, which in a first year is going to pay you somewhere between $18 and $22 an hour, depending on the trade, along with fully paid health care and pension benefits. So these are certainly very well-paying careers with great benefits.
Jeff, young people are often encouraged to plan for college. Do you think the building and construction trades get their due? I mean, is there even a bit of a negative connotation, maybe even a stigma, to working in those industries?
Well, I think there clearly is, and this is a lot of what we've really worked towards changing over the past, especially the past 2 to 3 years. You know, once that cracker plant was announced in Beaver County, that's where we really had the ramp up and really saw the need, where we really needed to add far more people than we typically would be adding into the union construction workforce. And, you know, so many times these careers are viewed as somehow substandard. There's a belief that you're laid off all the time. There's a belief that you really don't make the kind of money that you would make going through a going through a 4-year traditional college program. And nothing further from that could be true. We have people that are third and fourth year apprentices that are making upwards of $100,000 or more per year, plus that benefit package. And very few industries or companies offer defined pension programs anymore. Right. You know, it's typically a 401k, which can have great fluctuations. So there's a security there as you move through your career. And as I said, they require technical skills and math skills. The careers in construction trades, quite frankly, are every bit STEM as the traditional STEM careers we think about.
Right. Jeff, one more quick question. How important was it for you to make this first class as diverse and inclusive as possible?
Well, and that's a major point of this particular program, is we really focus on residents of the city and the county. Our goal, of course, anyone that qualifies certainly is eligible to come into the program. But we really focus into neighborhoods that are either low income or minority neighborhoods, underserved neighborhoods. And disadvantaged neighborhoods are not just minority neighborhoods. It cuts across the board. But with this particular class that we started today, we have 22 folks in it, and 19 are African-American. One is a female. The other three are white males. It's still tough getting women to come into the trades. I think a lot of women just don't see themselves being able to do a lot of these particular careers, and nothing could be further from the truth.
So you still have some work to do for recruitment in that area.
Right. From a general sense, we're getting more women. I think they're starting to recognize that they can really build a career. And this is not always about who can lift the most weight. There's a lot of creativity and so forth that comes into play as well. But, we're making inroads on the minority side, not as strong on the female side at this point. But, this all leads to the fact that we want to build a far more diverse workforce than we've had in the past. It's not only right, but from a business perspective, it makes all the sense in the world.
Jeff Nobers is the executive director of the Builders Guild of Western Pennsylvania. Thanks so much, Jeff.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
I'm Kevin Gavin. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
WYEP celebrates Women's History Month throughout March. Today, find out about Judy Mowat. In 1974, Rita Marley, Marcia Griffiths, and Judy Mowat gained fame as the I-3, Bob Marley's backing singers, beginning with his album Natty Dread and continuing until Marley's death in 1980. Judy Mowat's 1980 album, Black Woman, is considered the greatest reggae album by a woman. The self-produced album also holds the distinction of being the first reggae album produced by a woman. Mowat broke ground when she became the first woman nominated for a Reggae Grammy Award in 1985 for her album, Working Wonders. In 1999, the Jamaican government honored her by making her an officer in the Order of Distinction for her service to music. To hear full songs from all of our featured artists for Women's History Month, go to WYEP.org/women.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Federally subsidized school breakfast started as a pilot in 1966. Made a permanent program in 1975. Since then, educators and child advocates have been trying for years to make sure as many eligible children as possible take advantage of that first all-important meal of the day. Here in Pittsburgh and the surrounding region, a new report shows there's still a lot of work to be done. Patrick Dowd is the executive director for Allies for Children, and Chris West is the child nutrition outreach coordinator at the Greater Pittsburgh Community Food Bank. The two groups co-authored a report on school breakfast released Friday. Welcome to both of you. Good to have you here.
Thanks,
good
Kevin. Morning. Thanks for having us.
Nutritionally, how important is breakfast for children? Chris, let's start with you.
Yeah, it's key. There's so much research out there that shows breakfast, whether nutritionally, very important. But also academically. So it's important for kids. It helps with their memory, concentration. It shows that kids can get better test scores has been linked to breakfast. Attendance has been better linked to breakfast. So not only nutritionally and starting that, because your brain actually changes when you're fasting. Your brain is different than if you are full of food and ready to learn. So not only nutritionally, but academically as well.
Patrick.
Couldn't agree more. This is a really important program. And as you point out, it's been around for a long time. Really, the focus has been around school lunch. But the idea of really focusing on school breakfast is as critical as kids get to school and they start their day, making sure that they're ready to go. And, you know, you think about the hustle and bustle that we all go through in the morning, making sure that they have easy access, quick access to quality, nutritious foods, critical for their bodies, but also for their brains.
You get rid of that maybe natural sluggishness at the start of the day.
Exactly. I think about my kids, you know, the school days are starting early, and all that has to do with making sure that we're transporting kids to school, and so making sure that they have easy access. And that's really what the Greater Pittsburgh Community Food Bank and Allies for Children have been about, working with school districts to make it easier for kids to get access to that important meal.
I believe this is the fourth annual report for the two organizations done. So what would each of you point out as an important thing that you've learned from this report, Chris?
I'd say two things. One is alternative breakfast models are key for schools to really increase participation. So whether it's a grab and go or breakfast in the classroom or second chance breakfast. So that's one thing. The second thing is that those need support. I think not just putting a new model into place, but making sure there's communication home to parents and to students and raffles and energizing kids around the new model. So I'd say those two things are key to really increasing participation.
I couldn't agree more. And I would only add that if you look over the last several years, there's been an increase, a steady increase in the number of school districts that are serving a larger percentage of their population. So we've doubled from, I think, 4 to 8 over the last 2 years alone, the number of school districts that are serving more than 50% of the total student population. And we now have, again, up to 12 school districts in Allegheny County that are serving more than 60% of their free and reduced lunch population. And to Chris's point, it's really about how you do that work. So our two organizations worked with the Hillman Family Foundations and were able to support 5 school districts in the 17-18 year. And because of the way the data is collected, that really manifests itself in this report. You really see that change in that school year in this report. It's a lagging process. And so those school districts that instituted things like grab and go carts and things of that sort, again, making it easier for kids, breakfast after the bell, breakfast in the classroom, those districts saw dramatic increases. And our two organizations advocated at the state level for things like mini grants, and 22 schools here in Allegheny County have implemented those programs, and we'll see those manifest, the positive results manifest themselves in the next year's report.
I'm going to get more into some of those alternatives both brought up, but why would an eligible student not participate?
Part of it is around just easy access. So if you think about the change in a transportation system, for example, suddenly kids are getting to school later and they have to get to classroom quicker. So if they don't have a really quick way to pick up breakfast, that's going to be a problem. Quite frankly, the other element is stigma. If you're a low-income student, you don't want to get access. You want to get access to these programs, to these meals. It used to be very difficult to do that without being signaled as a low-income student. And so these kinds of models that we're working with the districts on change that and make it easier for kids to get access, and all kids, quite frankly, to get access.
And some other things I've seen is just the location of the cafeteria. A cafeteria could be on the clear other end of the building from where students come in, and their choice is, do I walk to the cafeteria to get breakfast, or do I stay here and hang out with my friends? And a lot of times they're going to choose stay there and hang out with their friends.
I want to in the stigma category, some school districts in Allegheny County, in the southwestern Pennsylvania, they include wealthier communities and lower income communities. Do you think that it's stigmatizing for children from lower income families within the same district to participate when they attend school in a overall wealthier district?
One of the schools that we worked with was in North Hills, so fits perfectly in that category. And they, percentage-wise, they saw the most dramatic increase in the number of students participating in school breakfast. But they have a low-income population there, and so this program was made available, so lots of kids could take advantage of it, those kids who could afford to buy the breakfast, those kids who couldn't. And it was all streamlined and made easy, and you can see in the report that there was a pretty significant increase in the number of kids participating. So proves the point exactly.
Chris, in your joint report, it looks like participation ranges from 0% up to more than 90%, if I read the bar graph correctly. So how are districts in Allegheny County doing compared to the state on average?
Great question.
Yeah, a little better. So we're faring a little better than the state. The state is at 53% feeding low-income kids breakfast. Allegheny County is at 57%. And so we're hopeful that even by next school year that we're going to hit the governor's goal in Allegheny County of 60%. So with all this work and all the momentum, and especially the grants that Patrick mentioned, the state giving 22 schools in Allegheny County, that we're hopeful we're going to see a big increase.
I think Chris is exactly right. This is a real opportunity for Allegheny County to hit it out of the park relative to the rest of the state. And we're doing a lot of great work. We have great school districts that are interested. We have great partners that are doing this work. And most importantly, kids and parents are excited about it.
Are more districts adopting those alternatives? Yeah. And I'd like you to explain a little bit about grab and go and breakfast in the classroom. So it's not just one set time and having to run over there, maybe not getting there in time.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Grab and go is typically a cart put in kind of the main entrance. So kids walk in the school, They grab something from the cart and then either eat in the cafeteria or the classroom. Breakfast in the classroom is, so in Pennsylvania, it's breakfast is actually counted as instructional time. So kids can start their day with breakfast while the teacher is taking attendance or going over yesterday's lesson or they're finishing their homework. And Second Chance is a model that is, in case kids didn't get breakfast, maybe they got there late, maybe the bus was late. So in between first and second period, so kids can grab a quick breakfast to start their day to make sure that they get it as well.
And just a couple quick things. If you look at the report, you'll see in there a couple of case studies or little examples. And so it's on our website, alliesforchildren.org. But a couple of quick points. Plum Borough, School District has done a great job of creating a kind of sort of a really hip place for kids to gather in the morning. So that's it attracts kids. Woodland Hills moved their cart from, created a cart to an easy access location. To Chris's point, it was really far to walk to the cafeteria so they could just grab and move it quickly. And then you'll see all sorts of different examples in the report.
Well, since you got kids involved, what about kids involved in maybe some of the offerings?
Oh, yeah. In Plum, that's actually the case. They're doing actually some of the work, and it's an opportunity for them to gather experience in the workplace working with their peers.
Yeah. They life skills students serve Second Chance breakfast in Plum, which is just a great example. And then we've also done surveys with kids so they can determine what they like, what they don't like in the menu, breakfast poster contests, all kinds of things to make sure that kids' voices are heard and that they're active participants.
Is there a lack of awareness, though, about availability?
I think it's a culture change. We're all learning how to adjust to this. As a parent, I had to learn how to adjust to this. I think we all are.
Okay, we have just a couple minutes left. You mentioned earlier about the Wolf administration's statewide participation goal of 60%. That's 60 students getting breakfast for every 100 who get lunch. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Now, is this achievable? Sounds like it is in Allegheny County. Is that still too low, though?
No, it's a threshold that we want to cross so that we can actually do more work. The idea is that these meals are available; they're paid for by the federal government. We should be taking access, and the access is there. We should be taking advantage of those resources, and we really think that getting to 60% is really a threshold that we need to cross to really push this forward.
And one of you mentioned, I think it was Chris, that said that hey, we could do this in the next year.
That's right.
Across over 60%. So then, do you set your own goals beyond the governor's goals?
Sure. Yeah, we'd love to see higher than that. I think, like Patrick said, 60% is the threshold we want to cross. But then after that, I think, as many kids as possible getting breakfast is what we're trying to do, because breakfast can be a great equalizer, get all the kids on the same footing, ready to start the day. And as many kids as take advantage of that as possible is what we'd love to see.
In just a couple of sentences each, I'd like your thoughts on what can be done next. You mentioned how many school districts are using these expanded alternatives. How do you get more of them involved to take part in other opportunities?
Yeah, I would grab and go has become really popular. A lot more school districts are doing that. So I would encourage schools. We're always sending out grant opportunities. We ourselves can help with funding. So I would encourage schools to take us up on those grant funding, get some equipment that they can do an alternative model, and use our technical assistance. We're happy to help any way we can.
And this is a low-cost opportunity, really easy to do.
And so your next steps to do this? I mean, are you recruiting school districts?
Exactly. We're continuing to recruit school districts to apply these alternative models. And as Chris points out, there's funding available to do that work.
And do you leverage the current participating districts? Say, hey, look what we're
Absolutely.
Doing.
Absolutely. And it's all about, having them understand what the needs are in their particular buildings. And then we try to think about the partners that we've worked with and help show the models that would work for them.
Patrick Dowd is the Executive Director for Allies for Children. Chris West is the Child Nutrition Outreach Coordinator at the Greater Pittsburgh Community Food Bank. Thanks so much for both of you being here today.
Thanks, Kevin.
Thank you.
And for today, that is the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, workforce experts project tens of thousands of jobs will become available over the next decade as workers retire. We'll talk with Earl Buford, CEO of Partner for Work, the local workforce development organization. If you missed anything from today's program or you want to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you find your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance by Meg Fair, Mick Stanelli, Joe Yazenkovich, and Alex Lenigan. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.